Hello and welcome to the Ship.Energy podcast. This is Mark Williams speaking to you from sunny Cambridgeshire in the UK, where spring has finally sprung, and indeed it is sunny today. My guest today is Joshua Politis. Joshua is Deputy Managing Director of Transport Capital, an investment management and financial advisory company focused on maritime and aviation with offices in six countries around the world. Joshua is talking to us today from Singapore. Joshua joined Transport Capital in 2019 and shares overall responsibility for the strategy and performance of the company. He drives the company's sustainability strategy and realigns the business with best practice ESG principles and spearheads the progress of the company's sustainable finance solutions. Joshua has over 15 years' experience in international management with a proven track record within the maritime and offshore energy industries. Prior to joining Transport Capital, he was Director and General Manager of Asia Pacific at Seacor Marine. And over the course of his career, he's worked on four continents and developed an extensive international senior-level network in maritime and offshore energy industries. Joshua holds an Executive MBA from the Singapore Management University. So Joshua, thank you very much for appearing and welcome to the show.
Hi Mark, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
Glad to have you on. And the reason I wanted to get you on was because Transport Capital impressed me immensely by being very proactive in publishing a sustainability report in 2020, in which you discuss your realignment of business with things like the UN Sustainable Development Goals and so on. So perhaps we could start by asking you to tell us a little bit about your sustainability report and why you felt it was important for a company like yours to produce one.
Yes, sure. I mean, so we issued our first sustainability report last year, and we're working on our second at the moment, which we're hoping to publish, I think next month. And so we really started thinking about this probably, at the start of the pandemic. I mean, where we're all this talk of sustainability, decarbonization, ESG, really was kind of, given a lot of momentum. And I mean, we think that we've always, operated in a sustainable way just because, that's part of the DNA of the company and of the founders, where we just we feel that we personally want to work, in a fair workplace and in somewhere that values, doing things the right way. But we also recognized, and especially in the financial markets, there was more and more kind of pressure on bigger companies to effectively, put in place processes and procedures and document everything that we're doing. And so we took the view that since we're doing it anyways, and it seems like this is eventually anyways going to come to all companies, we think that, this will be like audited accounts and an annual report, if it's disclosed publicly or not, this is just going to become the new normal. And so we thought that, why not just get ahead of it and go out there and do it. And I really think it was a really interesting experience. I think we learned a lot doing it. And actually it was a very beneficial experience. We didn't see it, as an additional cost or as something that we were forced to do. And, it helped us to really rethink, everything that we're doing and see, we were doing a lot of things well, and there's things that we can improve. I think we set some goals. We added some policies that we were missing. So we really thought we learned a lot from it. And I think both for our own business and also, I mean, our core customers, the core clientele which we work with is mainly in the private markets and is, small and medium-sized ship owners. And I think it also taught us a lot, of what needs to be done. And we think that we can also use this experience to add value to our clients when we're working with them on projects. And so the first sustainability report, we really took an emphasis on the E part of it, the environmental and everything that we're doing for the environment. But, the S and the G are also important. And now on the second one, we're focusing on the S, on the social aspect of it and trying to, highlight what we're doing both within the business, within our activities. It's a lot easier to talk about the environmental side of it, especially in maritime, right? I mean, everything is now around, decarbonization and lowering emissions. But The S and the G are extremely important as well, you know, especially from an investor's perspective, where, you know, having a company, a counterparty that is strong on the S side, you know, that treats its people well, that treats its crew well, that has diversity in its staff, and on the G, on the governance, you know, that has strong policies, is you know, a very is a very good way of kind of, you know, identifying good counterparties. And I strongly believe that companies that score strongly on the S and the G, you know, will be a lot safer investments and a lot better partners to work with.
It certainly makes counterparty due diligence rather easier, doesn't it, if you've got some of those strong governance elements in place, as well as some of the social aspects of the business, certainly on the governance side, if you're thinking about transparency and beneficial ownership and so on. That certainly makes your requirement to do KYC a little bit easier, doesn't it, if everybody's being a little bit more open about their governance particulars.
It does, definitely. And it also gives us a lot more comfort, you know, that these are people we want to do business with, and that, you know, in the end, if it's a debt instrument that will pay back, or, you know, if it's an equity investment that, you know, will be there in the long term. Because I think, you know, especially with shipping, the two things that can really go wrong are, you know, too much debt and the wrong structures, which mean that, you know, when times get tough, these companies don't survive. And so I think it's a great way of differentiating and making better investments.
Yeah. Well, we look forward to seeing the second sustainability report, and if our listeners want to access those, they can access them at your website, I believe.
Yes. We do publish it on our website.
So that's transportcapital.com, and follow the links. I'm thinking about your counterparties. You mentioned that you work more frequently than not with the sort of smaller independent ship owners. How do you assess, as part of the energy transition, especially thinking about the E in ESG, their ability to access capital for low carbon fleet investment at the moment?
We think it's difficult. It is challenging, especially given the fact that lower emission vessels are inherently more expensive than conventionally fueled vessels. You know, either because you have to put additional equipment on the vessel, or you will be using fuels that are, you know, green fuels that are inherently more expensive, and, you know, not as efficient as conventional diesel. There is no, you know, it is really, you know, other than the pollution, it is the perfect fuel. So these vessels will always be more expensive to build. Retrofit economics are still challenging. So most of these will be new build projects. And both of those are more challenging for smaller ship owners. I think there are pools of capital and very competitive capital in the alternative space, but that is usually focused on older vessels. Because, you know, a lot of the depreciation risk or the residual value risk has been minimized there, or they might be higher cost options, which don't really work well with a new build that already costs more money. And in general, I mean, I think, as you know, the bank market has had this flight to quality, so they look for, you know, much bigger counterparties and strong balance sheets. And so you do have some pockets, you know, especially in Europe, some kind of regional newer fund structures that have come up, but with very strict mandates. So, you know, either on types of vessels or on types of counterparties, most of them are pretty much European focused. So there are not very many options for mid-sized ship owners, even if they have their customers who are willing to give them a long-term contract that will compensate them for the additional capex. It's still very challenging to get the finance, both on the debt side and even on the equity side, because a lot of these companies won't necessarily have, you know, the 50% equity to put into these projects, even if they have a bank that's there to put the other 50%. So we think that this is a big gap in the market, and one that needs to be addressed, and which we're working on. I mean, we've noticed, you know, over the last few years that, you know, our clients that we work with who want solutions for these newer, greener projects, there just really aren't many solutions in the market. And so You know, that's one of our goals, is to actively go out there and help to create these new solutions to allow these ship owners to go out there. Because, you know, you cannot decarbonize maritime shipping without mid-sized ship owners. You know, if you look at the statistics, you know, if you take ship owners, you know, with 20 to 80 vessels, which are pretty big, but, you know, which would consider medium size, that's over a third of the fleet. So you have, you know, the big ship owners with over 80 vessels, yeah, that is about a third. And then the small ones, which is a lot of ship owners, which is one, two, three, four ships, you know, the other third. But that core there, mm-hmm, is very important, because we think, you know, consolidation is important and works in certain sectors. But shipping is so diverse. There's so many different cargoes, there's so many different ship types, that you cannot have, you know, a few big companies doing everything. You need smaller entrepreneurial, you know, nifty companies that go out there, that have these strong commercial relationships with charters, that are specialized in certain trades and certain routes. And you need them to be able to invest in these lower emission ships, because if not, we will never get, you know, the emissions of shipping down. And so we think that this is a key that needs to be unlocked. And I'm optimistic. I mean, I think, you know, we're seeing the right steps. It's still early days, but you know, we are working very hard to get more options out there, so that we can see an acceleration of these projects to decarbonize shipping.
Yeah, most of the focus, as you say, has been on the very large corporates, you know, like the big liner companies or the very large Japanese industrial shipping companies. But that Mittelstand is what makes up the spot market, isn't it? And without the Mittelstand, without that middle element of ship owners, as you say, the sort of 20 to 80 fleet operators and owners, then the market can't function.
Yep, that is completely correct. And so, and I think if you look at Europe, you know, you're seeing positive signs. I mean, still not on the deep sea shipping, but on short sea shipping. You know, you're seeing more and more projects, you know, and this, the fleet is very old, right? I mean, the short sea fleet is probably 25, 30 years old. So you need to renew it, and you need to build new. But I think in terms of what the European governments are doing, in terms of the subsidies that you're seeing in Norway, you know, for hydrogen, in Holland, for, you know, putting up the infrastructure required on the Rhine to swap batteries, what you're seeing in Germany, you know, there is a lot of capital that's being deployed as subsidies and as grants. You're seeing charterers, you know, willing to pay premiums to get these ships ordered, to get these ships on the water. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's probably all being driven by the end consumer, right? And the citizens of Europe, who are really demanding it. And you're seeing that flow up the chain. So, I mean, look, I am optimistic. It's still very early days, and you're still seeing a lot of conventionally fueled vessels being built, because, you know, it's obviously not, you know, so widespread that it affects everything. But I think you're seeing the start, and you're seeing first movers come out. And so the same way as you need first movers in deep sea shipping, you know, you're seeing that come out in the smaller sectors. And I actually think that being a first mover is, you know, has a very strong, very interesting business case to it, right? You know, in shipping, we've always thought, yeah, first movers, you know, yep, it's never a good idea to be a first mover. It's too risky. But I think in this case, not necessarily, because I think new business models will be developed. You know, new shipping will change over the next 10 to 15 years. Decarbonization is not as simple as just swapping one fuel for another, right? I mean, I think we can go into it, but, you know, we don't think that it's going to be, you know, there's going to be one solution, right? There will be multiple solutions, and in different geographies or different ship types will necessitate different types of green fuels. And so that will change, you know, business models and change how companies operate. And I think, you know, being part of the first movers, sure, is actually, you know, there's actually quite a bit of benefit to be there and to shape, you know, how the future goes. And I don't think necessarily as it historically, yeah, has been, where, you know, the laggards will kind of benefit from, you know, the risks that the first movers have taken. I think here, there really are benefits to be at the forefront, even if you're not the Maersk, you know, as big as a Maersk. You know, you can develop kind of the future in the niches where you operate.
Yeah, I think I would entirely agree. And in fact, I've coincidentally, I've just published a piece on the ship.energy website about how fortune favours the bold, but we could do with governments to favour the bold as well at the moment, you know, sort of talking about the risks that early adopters take and how we should applaud them and support them where we can. So it's great to hear it. Yes, I think that I would also agree that, you know, we're looking at this multi-fuel future, and I believe you've been looking at different hydrogen-based fuels and LNG as well, haven't you? And I was wondering how you see their use evolving over time, because we've seen just in the last few days comments from Europe saying, you know, LNG, I wouldn't order LNG ships now. Maybe LNG is, you know, had its day. We should be leapfrogging straight over to hydrogen-based fuels. And of course, we've also seen with geopolitical events just recently that there's a requirement to invest both in sufficient hydrocarbon capacity to tide us over and to accelerate the energy transition to get us away from hydrocarbons and the political complications that come with them.
Yes. So, I mean, this is a very political issue, right? And there are some very strong views, you know, in every way. I mean, I think we look at this very pragmatically. I mean, is LNG perfect? No. If we could leapfrog directly, should we? Of course. But can we? We don't think so. The reality is there is no green ammonia today. There is no green methanol today. Using brown methanol or brown ammonia is actually, you're probably better off just using conventionally fueled vessels, right? If you look at it on a well-to-weight basis, there is no benefit. Mm-hmm. Using LNG in the right way, you know, with a minimized methane slate, the slip with a high pressure engine on a well-to-weight basis, you can still achieve that 20%, right? Which, okay, is not huge, but it's definitely better than nothing. And, you know, shipping today is what, 2.5-3% of global emissions. So somewhere between Japan and Germany, if you want to put it, you know, next to the country. I don't think it's an option to do nothing for 10 years in the hope that, you know, these green fuels will not only be available, but will be available in, you know, at an economic cost and with the infrastructure developed in all the major ports to be able to supply them. I hope that is the case, but I don't think it's prudent to bet everything on that scenario. So LNG today is available in say, what, 200 ports on its route to 250 ports. The bunkering, you know, vessels are being ordered. You're starting to see even bio-LNG being produced in Europe and blended into some fuels. There is work on synthetic LNG. So for the most part of shipping, right, let's call it deep sea shipping, where electricity is not an option, batteries are not an option, eventually green fuels will be, but those green fuels don't exist today, LNG is the only option. So either, I see two scenarios. You build a conventionally fueled vessel today, calling it, you know, LNG, ammonia ready or methanol ready or whatnot, do nothing for 10 years and then hope that in 10 years, everything is fine. Or you can order that same vessel, pay a little bit more money, order it as a dual fuel LNG vessel, save a minimum of 20% of the emissions for the next 10 years, hopefully more if you can start blending in bio LNG, and then, you know, convert that to green ammonia at a much lower cost, right? The conversion from an LNG dual fuel vessel to an ammonia burning vessel, especially if you plan it right, you know, from the beginning, will be a lot simpler and a lot less costly than just doing it from a conventionally fueled vessel. So I think our view is, you know, given where we are, if we want to have any chance of aligning with Paris, we need to start reducing emissions today. We cannot wait for 2030. It will be that much harder, and we'll have spent that much more of our carbon budget by 2030 if we will have done nothing than if we can at least get that 20%. And I think the more that you develop that, the more the infrastructure will come up, the more demand you'll see for bio-LNG, and who knows, even synthetic methane, you know, can be an option, right? You know, for the life of these ships that are delivering, you know, say you order today in 2024, mm-hmm. you know, by 2050, even by just using LNG, you may see a path, you know, to 80, 90, or I mean, I guess with carbon accounting, you can even be carbon neutral or carbon negative. Today, with a conventionally fueled vessel, I don't see that, right? I don't see how just purely on biofuels you can get there. So, look, I think we just need to be realistic. And I don't think for us it's an option, you know, that we can say that, okay, we're better off doing nothing for 10 years and hoping that everything happens. Now, at the same time, You know, you need to develop, we need to do something to develop, you know, the infrastructure and the need for these green fuels, right? And I think on the short sea market, that's where you can start to do a lot of these things, right? You can focus on electricity, you can work, you can implement, you can have first movers that push, you know, to use. We're working on a project in Norway, which will use compressed hydrogen with a fuel cell. Obviously, that won't work for the deep sea, right? That can give you maybe 3 days of sailing time, but that's okay for the short sea routes that that's working on. So I think we need to combine, you know, reducing deep sea shipping by, say, 20-25% using LNG, while pushing our efforts onto the zero carbon fuels onto the short sea and the harbor and the harbor sector. Build up that knowledge, build up the use cases, the infrastructure, the safety standards, the trainings, and then we'll have a much better chance in 2030, you know, of really bringing those fuels into the deep sea shipping. That's how I see it, at least.
Yeah. I think interesting to hear you talk about the training there, and well, two elements really that I would like to bring out from what you've just covered there. First of all, investors and financiers have to get up the technology curve pretty quickly now, don't they? I mean, this is, as you say, we can't wait. We need to understand this now. And secondly, how important do you believe the educational aspect of maritime decarbonisation is? You know, across the entire structure of organisations, from board level down to, you know, the most green deckhand.
I think it's very important, right? Because I think it's so complicated, right? You need to be aware of all the different developments with the different fuels. I mean, you can make big mistakes, right? You don't want to build a ship that can use green ammonia while you have a trade where there's no chance that it's ever going to be there, right? I mean, for me, the key example is LNG, right? You know, you need to be aware of things like methane slip, right? You know, because as of today, the IMO is only looking at regulating carbon, but that obviously is not sustainable, right? If we're talking about greenhouse gases, methane is potent. So I think, you know, what not knowing from an investor's point of view is, if you say finance an LNG dual fuel ship today, but that has a high methane slip, right? If ever methane were to be regulated, which I think the chances are, you know, very likely, and I think outside of shipping, you know, the move is definitely there to regulate methane, well, then you seriously have a stranded asset risk to consider, right? Because if you have a ship that's the, you know, burning 10 times as much, or is it letting 10 times as much methane slip as another option, and that methane gets regulated, well, that ship, well, there won't be very much demand for that ship. So either you have to then do a very costly conversion, or, you know, you will have lost a significant part of your investment. So, and I think, Then you have to look into different options, into ammonia, into methanol, into how it's produced, into well-to-wake, you know, emission cycles. So even without going on to, you know, the operations and the trading of the ships, I think from a company looking at investing in different options, and from an investor who's looking to, you know, put capital to work, you need to get familiar with a lot of different technologies, and you need to really understand them well to be able to assess the risks. Because I think this goes down to, you know, it's an easy answer that a lot of people are making is, yeah, you know, we wait for the technology to be ready. You know, it's all a technology problem. I don't think it's a technology problem. I think all the technology we need exists today. Yes, if you're going into, you know, fuel cells and batteries, I think you can see, you know, over the next 10 years, you'll see some pretty high advances on that front. But if you're talking about, you know, the internal combustion engine and using that to use green fuels, that technology is there and has existed for a long time. And yes, it gets a little bit more efficient over time. But, you know, dual fuel engines have been there for 20 years. And I don't think there's going to be a radical change in that. Where what we need is the ability to produce these fuels in a green manner at a cost or at a competitive cost, and, you know, to deploy the infrastructure to bunker them. But it's not a technology issue. You know, the ammonia is the only one where there's no engine yet, and that will be there in 2024, at the last I heard, if not 2023. So, you know, I think it's it's complex, but the solutions are there, and I think you need to be diligent into looking deep down and not just on the surface. And that's where I saw an article, you know, at the beginning of the week that the IMO is starting to look into, you know, well-to-wake, or is thinking about regulating on a well-to-wake basis. And I think that's so important, because it's not only what you emit on the ship itself. It's the whole life cycle of the fuel that can completely change the amount of emissions that you're saving or that you're reducing. So I think education is key to really get deeply familiar with all these different technologies.
Yeah, I quite agree. And that educational aspect is something quite dear to our heart at Shipping Strategy as well. So it's good to hear it. Joshua, we're running out of time, which is a great shame because I could talk all day. I think it's fascinating to get your perspectives, and I hope everyone out there in podcast land agrees. I'm sure they do. But thank you so much for taking the time out to come and talk to us today on the Ship.Energy podcast. And it's been great to get your views and your contribution. Really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
And I hope that we get to catch up soon. I'll make sure I come to see you next time I'm in Singapore.
Yeah, please do. I look forward to it.
Okay, thanks. And thanks to everybody out there in podcast land. And we look forward to getting you onto the next edition of the Ship.Energy podcast coming your way in about 2 weeks' time. Thanks and goodbye.